Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Daniel Paris, host of the New Books in Finance channel, a channel of the New Books Network. I am pleased to have as my guest today William Gale, the author of Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Bill Gale is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and has spent a long time thinking about, and it's obvious from the book, thinking about the debt crisis that our country is facing and has come up with some pretty detailed prescriptions as to how we can try to manage them. Bill, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
You're facing just an enormous challenge head on, but as a historian, I have to say one of the things that I like that you do is placing the debt crisis that the government is staring down in a historical context. And as you say, you know, why it matters that we understand how the government's debt emerged and why it's a problem. Can you kind of go over some of that background material that helps set the stage for, you know, kind of what you consider the main issues?
Sure. One of the reasons I included a chapter on fiscal history is that I was hoping to look back over 200 plus years and, you know, find the magic formula for solving the debt problem that we face. And then it turned out that exactly the opposite occurred. The main lesson from our history is that the situation we face now is different than any situation we faced in the past. In the first 200 years of the country, we only had rising debt during wars or recessions. As soon as the war ended or the economy recovered, the debt came back down. So that there was a temporary spike and then it abated after the initial episode ended. Then Ronald Reagan was elected and he cut taxes and raised military spending in the early 80s, which caused the debt to rise for the first time when we didn't have a war or a recession. That led to a whole series of changes which controlled the problem for about 20 years. But then starting with George W. Bush and then the Great Recession and then the recent tax cuts, debt has just risen again. So the situation we face now is we have this sort of permanent imbalance, sort of a chronic imbalance between what people expect the government to spend and what people are willing to pay in taxes. And that's sort of built in now to the budget. And that's different from any episode we've had historically. So it's a cause for concern in the sense that we've never had permanent deficits baked into the cake.
One of the issues, again, I work in finance, so I touch upon this, but I'm also a historian, that the debt challenge that I see, it was exacerbated by a phenomenon which I don't know, you know, how it plays in terms of government planning, because I don't know that they think about this in the same terms that I do. But we had interest rates declining from the very, very high levels, mid-teen levels in the early 1980s, You'll remember Paul Volcker conquering inflation and so forth. We've had interest rates decline for 35 years from that point to the nadir in 2016. And I don't know if this you came across this or not, but during that period of declining interest rates, corporations, individuals, and I guess I'm asking whether governments felt, unlike the other times that you reference in your history, that debt was good, fine, and manageable. Because every time interest rates decline, and if they decline over a 35-year period, your debt burden diminishes and you feel better about yourself. So I guess my question is, did declining interest, you said this time it's different because of the Reagan tax reforms, but is it also different because of this 35-year period of declining interest rate when everyone just naturally assumed they could take on more debt and handle it more easily? Or was that something that did not come up?
That definitely comes up. Low interest rates, which we're experiencing right now, are the one bright spot in terms of the fiscal outlook. Obviously, interest rates reduced the pressure on the government. Sorry, low interest rates reduced the pressure on the government to cut spending or raise taxes because it reduces government interest payments. But I feel like in the last few years, rather than capitalizing on low interest rates and a strong economy and putting into place policies that will reduce the long-term debt and deficits, policymakers have done the opposite. They've basically taken a strong economy and low interest rates as an opportunity to cut taxes and raise spending. So the concern is that we've sort of squandering the opportunity to fix things while things are good. You know?
Right, right. So the I don't know if, again, before we get back to your business, I'll get one last question from my perspective. Curiously, I have found, and I'm hoping this is the case because it's well-timed with your book, though I think ill-timed for the temper of the times, and you deal with this extensively in the book, but I have observed in corporate America over the last 12 to 18 months a change in sentiment in regard to debt. That is from the, and your book is mostly about government deficits, but private sector corporate deficits and debt was viewed very benignly until about a year and a half ago. And there's been a real sentiment change that, hey, this debt thing isn't as good as we thought, and we have to actually start paying down our debts. Now, Washington is not the same thing as corporate America, but has there been any change in sentiment coincidental with your research and your book as to taking this challenge on, or is it still the, and we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but is it still the just an intractable problem, or has this willingness to take on the problem gotten any better or worse or changed at all in the last 18 months? Because I can tell you it has in corporate America.
I think the willingness to take on the problem in the government has gone down. What happens whenever both houses in the White House are controlled by the same party, deficits go up. And that's exactly what happened the last couple of years. The Republicans cut taxes, then the Congress crafted a budget deal that raised spending. And that's a typical pattern you see, whether it's Kennedy, Johnson, Democrats in the 60s, or Bush, Republican in the 2000s, or President Obama in the first 2 years of his term when he had a Democratic Congress. And so there's been a reduction in concern about this on the right. And I think on the left, you're seeing the rise of things like modern monetary theory, where people are saying, well, look, you know, if the right's not going to focus on this, why should we focus this on this on the left? So,
and printing press it out of existence. Okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that your book then is, facing even a greater challenge, as it were, your arguments. Let's get to those prescriptions. Actually, before we get to those prescriptions, let's get to the utter enormity of the challenge, which I think some of us in finance know that, boy, are we out over our skis in terms of the debt. And you have great examples from around the world and throughout history as to, you know, the size of these obligations. But, you know, at the headline level, they are eye-popping. Do you want to share a couple, some of that.
Sure. Let me just throw out a couple of numbers out there, round numbers. The debt is currently about 80% as large as the economy. Under relatively optimistic assumptions, it's headed to 180% as large as the economy in 2050, in 30 years from now. I argue in the book that we should get it down to 60% of GDP, from 180 to 60. In order to do that, we would have to cut spending or raise taxes by about 4% of GDP a year. That's an enormous shift. We're talking something like $800 billion a year in today's dollars. And, that's well beyond anything that's being discussed in the political system. It's even several times larger than the tax cut we just had. And of course, the tax cut raises the deficit rather than reducing the deficit. So part of the problem, I think, with the fiscal outlook, part of the problem with getting politicians to deal with it is that when people are faced with a problem that's so big that they don't feel like they can solve it, I think there's a tendency to just ignore it.
And unfortunately, there's a standard that's been applied in terms of environmental issues and climate change that it's hard for an individual or even a group of individuals to see what they could do to meaningfully change it. And therefore, the easiest solution is to, from their perspective, is often to do nothing.
That's right. And the fiscal situation bears a number of resemblances to the climate change in that you can look around and say, well, there's no problem right now, but you can sort of predict, given the way things are headed, that there will be a problem. But it's very difficult to get the public to focus on the long-term issues because they have lives to lead and jobs and families. And it's very difficult to get politicians to focus on it because the last thing they want to do is raise issues that they're not ready to solve.
For which there's no simple answer. You point out that at any given moment, from moment to moment, the size of the government debt doesn't create a problem. But and therefore, it's not, as you characterize it, a wolves problem. It's more of a termites problem, which once the structure fails, it fails very rapidly. Do you want to discuss how, the metaphor and then, why this can't be put off, that it even though it appears to be benign for now, the Social Security Fund is solvent, the government can finance its debts, et cetera, but the termites are working busily and how does that play out?
Right. So my former colleague, Charlie Schultz, described deficits as termites in the woodwork, not the wolf at the door. And what he meant, and what I think he's right, is we're not facing a crisis. I think that sometimes people use that word too loosely. And there's two problems with doing that in the fiscal situation. One is obviously we can pay our debts for decades to come. The question is whether it's a good idea. But the other is that talking about a crisis implicitly suggests that the reason we should worry about the debt is that it might create a crisis. And I think we need to worry about the debt even if it doesn't create a crisis. There's a problem. It's just a gradual one, not a sudden one. And the gradual problem is that rising debt can either crowd out investment or force us to borrow more from overseas. But either way, once we do that, our future income will not grow as fast as it otherwise would have. And those cumulative effects can be substantial, even if there's no crisis.
And, all the more in this large crisis, but not an imminent crisis, the political situation that you described was terribly depressing. The way our system's set up and with the current allegiances, and you do point out this has been a problem over the years, but right now it seems particularly dire that a political consensus in Washington, D.C. to do something about this just doesn't doesn't appear to exist. You have a special chapter that deals with the, why Washington isn't likely to get this done on its own.
Yeah, so solving the long-term fiscal problem is just about the hardest problem that the U.S. political system will face. The biggest issue is the benefits are off in the future, and they're kind of diffuse. And so the people who will benefit, many of them can't vote yet. Many of them aren't even born yet. But the people who will bear the costs are, you know, living taxpayers. So what happens is the people who bear the costs can identify themselves as having costs. And so they oppose the change. Whereas because the beneficiaries are not really in the political system, they don't really have a voice. So a similar thing arises in climate change. Like if policies were made by our great grandchildren right now, who obviously, you know, they don't exist, but if they could kind of spirit themselves here and make policies, they would make very different climate change policies than we're making right now. So on top of that, the founding fathers deliberately designed the government to make it difficult to do big things, that you needed a lot of consensus. Mm-hmm, and public opinion, which is often an anchor for politicians, is hopelessly conflicted on this. The public, if you ask people, do you oppose rising debt and deficits, they'll say yes. And then if you ask them, well, do you oppose tax increases and spending cuts, which are needed to end the rising debt and deficits, they'll say yes. So if you're a politician, how you frame this is really important, and the public is not, you know, in a united front to do anything about this.
Are the policy wonks like you on both sides of the aisle more in agreement? That is, do you have some common ground with people at AEI and Heritage, or is it really, or do they share your concerns, but are they also just hopelessly divided like the rest of us?
So it's interesting. There's, in a nutshell, the book says we have this long-term deficit problem, long-term debt problem, and we need to have tax increases be a big part of the solution. And so my friends at AEI and Heritage will say, well, you've got the problem right, long-term debt, but you've got the solution wrong. And that in their view, the solution is we should cut spending.
So they're okay with the first half of the book, not so much the second half.
Right. On the left, the argument is you've got a great solution, raising taxes on high-income households and boosting spending on kids and infrastructure and stuff like that. So your solution is great, but deficits aren't really a problem to begin with. You know, they're mm-hmm. sort of trying to talk themselves into the fact that they can go ahead and enact big new spending initiatives without paying for it. So I've got something in common with both sides, but also some differences.
Well, I think you've managed to alienate everyone, which suggests to me that you're doing well. All of this is basically a prelude to, you know, the very specific policy prescriptions. And this is really, really tough. You've defined an enormous problem, and then you go step by step, category by category, silo by silo, with a very detailed prescription. And, you know, there's a great deal of bravery there, because you are pretty much tapping everyone's shibboleths and sacred cows and so forth. The first one is healthcare, and you know, you have a very clearly stated opinion on affordable care, on Medicare, but that, you know, the healthcare spending by the government is part of the problem, therefore it has to be part of the solution. You want to give us a kind of a summary version of how you would like to see that play out?
Sure. Healthcare is an enormous sector in the U.S. If the healthcare sector were a separate country, if the healthcare sector in the U.S. were a separate country, it would be the fourth largest country in the world. So we're talking about a massive set of suppliers and demanders. And I think there are two goals here. One is to make sure that everybody has access to decent care, that is increasing coverage. And the other is what people call bending the curve, reducing the growth rate of healthcare expenditures. And to focus on the second point, this seems to me to be one of the few areas in the budget where it's possible, I won't say quite to get something for nothing, but to get a lot for a little bit in benefit losses. So, for example, the way we pay medical providers tends to focus too much on the services they provide rather than the outcomes they generate. So there are initiatives that Medicare has started to change the way we pay doctors and hospitals to encourage economy of care. There's a very significant number of medical tests and procedures that are done that do not appear to be justified based on, you know, scientific evidence, which could be cut. And then there's this issue of drug pricing or drug costs. Medicare pays more for the same drugs than Medicaid or Veterans Affairs do, by a fairly sizable margin. And if Medicare paid the same prices as Medicaid, we could cut spending by $500 million over the next decade. So I think there are real savings to be had in healthcare, while at the same time improving coverage and possibly even improving the quality of care.
And sort of a political third rail, but you know, you do, as you say, go through all the parts of Medicare and the price challenges there. I in my day job deal with this somewhat in terms of drug pricing and the intermediaries, the PBMs and everything. And it is true that if you were setting up a system from scratch, you would never ever set up the system the way it is currently. There are gross inefficiencies there. If healthcare, however, is a hard nut to crack, you know, the political third rail is Social Security. And there you have very specific and logical, I didn't disagree with a single assertion. I did not disagree if I disagreed with some of the assertions, they were not all of them and not significantly, that is, they made a lot of sense. Yet it almost seems perhaps changing the Social Security rules is among the most hopeless tasks one could face, because it seems to be, you know, it started out as a modest, incremental, marginal program during the Roosevelt administration, has become something akin to a constitutional right in society now. And it's just going to be very, very difficult to change those numbers.
Yeah, Social Security, on the one hand, it may well be the most successful program the government's ever run. On the other hand, it's not sustainable the way it is right now. And if policymakers don't do anything else, they make no changes, benefits will have to be cut by law by about 23-25% starting in 2034. We can talk more about the specifics of Social Security, but the importance of Social Security to the budget debate is both that Social Security is a big part of government spending, is 20% about, but also because of this trust fund exhaustion date, it's sort of a hard constraint, whereas the rest of the deficit, the rest of the budget, the Congress can always put off one more day, one more week, one more month dealing with it. Problem will be a little worse, but they avoided annoying their constituents for that time period. With Social Security and with Medicare, there are hard deadlines where the trust funds run out of money, and therefore benefits have to be cut by law. And that you know, nobody wants to see that as the outcome, I don't think, but that could well force action both on those initiatives and on the bigger budget issue.
Well, let's hope that's the case. So, the healthcare and Social Security, you might, in reforming them, and Social Security, you might characterize as sticks. There's some degree of carrot, though, that you put in. You, at the same time that you're trying to reduce expenditures, you're also trying to increase investment. And a lot of people I deal with popularly may not get the difference between consumption and investment, and kind of broad definitions of investment, like early childhood education and so forth. But you have a section where, you know, you kind of round out the cost cutting with areas where you think it would benefit our society and the economy and ultimately the long-term balance sheet of society by increasing investments, or at least protecting them both in people and in government projects. You want to discuss that a bit?
Yeah. So let me take a step back. There are sort of two themes to the book. One is the problems of rising debt, and the other is the problems of lagging investment in key areas. And the basic idea is that fiscal adjustments are going to be necessary because of the debt, but we can use them as an opportunity to fix other aspects of society. And investment in children, investment in infrastructure, R&D, when you look at the numbers and read the studies of that, it's clear that more investment in those areas would be effective for society in all sorts of ways, not just the straight economic, people are more productive, they'll earn higher wages, but all that is kind of ancillary effects, and better neighborhoods, lower crime rates, better health, better mental health. There's a variety of studies of these government safety net programs that suggest they have very broad effects, and they should be thought of as investments in human capital rather than just government spending.
Which is, I think, back to the politics section. Half the population agrees with you, but the other half, unfortunately, doesn't. And so that almost applies to each of these categories. But again, that difference between investment and kind of versus expenditure or consumption is lost on a lot of people.
Well, this is something that I think analysts on the right and left do agree on, that we need to reorient government spending from consumption to investment. And this will, investment will literally and figuratively pay dividends in the future. Now, there can be debates about what the right area to invest in, but I think if there's a single area where people agree on most, it's that we need more infrastructure investment. We need to renew our existing infrastructure and build new infrastructure for the 21st century.
So let's shift to the revenue raising, not just the savings, but the revenue raising. And again, here it's a political landmine, but taxes on people and taxes on business. You've got some harsh medicine, the numbers are what they are. And you want to kind of provide some highlights on that?
Sure. If you look at the fiscal outlook, we've already got a problem with existing programs. If we try to invest more in kids and infrastructure, that makes the problem bigger. We can save some money in Social Security and Medicare, but ultimately we are going to have to raise taxes. The arithmetic is overwhelming. And if we're going to raise taxes, we might as well use it as an opportunity to reform the tax system as well. So I think the most distinctive part of the tax agenda is pushing for a carbon tax, both for climate change reasons and for budget reasons, and pushing for a value-added tax, which is essentially a national consumption tax that every other country in the world has except us. And those two would do a lot to close the fiscal gap in ways that would not hurt the economy much, if at all. A consumption tax does not impinge on saving investment. A carbon tax corrects the problem in the economy that the price of carbon is too low, because it does not include the costs that carbon emissions impose on society as a whole. And so there are ways to reform the income tax as well. You talked about going after sacred cows. I feel like we should get rid of the mortgage interest deduction. It does not do what people think it does, raise home ownership. It costs a lot of money. It's now extremely regressive. I think we need to let the 2017 tax cut, the temporary provisions of that tax cut, expire. I didn't think we could afford them long term when we passed them, and the situation since then has only, you know, has only confirmed that in my view. There are changes we can make to the corporate tax to make it both more investment friendly and more revenue producing. The cuts in the 2017 Act, I think some of them were not well advised. And finally, tax evasion in this country is an enormously under-discussed phenomenon. There's about $600 billion a year that goes in unpaid taxes. One out of every six dollars in taxes that are owed are not paid. And we know generally where this money is. It's sole proprietorships, farms, rents, and extremely high-income households. But we have not equipped the IRS with anything near what it needs to enforce the system. So we could rein in a decent amount of revenue simply by giving the IRS the resources to enforce the tax system better.
Let me. You kind of agreed on that point, and the IRS has been kind of detoothed, defanged for a long time. I want to go back to the VAT though, because I think it's a really interesting one, and people will argue about the levels of income taxes, whether it's regressive and so forth. People can argue about the corporate tax, how it'll affect. We have a live experiment going on right now with a recent tax law change. But the VAT, as you point out, is different. It's not used here. It's used everywhere else. And given that, you know, a tax on consumption, to me, at a certain level, makes a great deal of sense. But almost like every other silo and every other prescription, VAT is opposed on both the far left and the far right in a way that Larry Summers in a very funny manner captured. Do you want to summarize his witticism about it, because it makes a lot of sense?
Sure. And by the way, Summers said this about 30 years ago, and it's been one of the most prophetic statements in economics that anyone has ever made. He was asked why the U.S. does not have a value-added tax, and he said that liberals fear that it's regressive and conservatives fear that it's a money machine. And then he was asked, well, when will we get a value-added tax? And he basically said, when liberals realize it's a money machine and conservatives realize it's regressive.
Regressive.
And yeah. I think that captures the political feelings about the tax very well. I don't think the political feelings accurately reflect the reality, though. So, for example, countries that have value-added taxes have not inexorably increased their revenues over time. They've been fairly stable the last 20, 30 years. Likewise, the VAT itself is regressive, but there are policies that can accompany it, like rebates for low-income households or spending.
Or just very low-income taxes for low-income families.
Exactly.
At a higher threshold that you start paying income tax at a higher level, and that offsets the regressiveness of the VAT.
Exactly. So there are ways to offset. The VAT itself is regressive, but there are ways to have policies combined with it that offset that, in fact, even enhance the progressivity. That's basically what European countries do, is they have larger social spending than we do, and financed in large part by value-added tax.
And have you, again, I'm keen on the sentiment of the time, any change in, it's been 30 years since Larry Summers said this, any change, diminishment or improvement in terms of the prospect of a VAT? I get the sense that it's dead even before arrival, even though from my perspective, it actually makes a fair amount of sense. And as you said, it is common pretty much everywhere else in the world. But there is no support in the United States for VAT. Is that unfortunately a fair statement?
It's sort of like the Voldemort of the tax system. Like nobody will say its name, but there have been numerous proposals by Republicans and Democrats and bipartisan commissions over the last decade that basically take a value-added tax and call it something different, like a business transfer tax or something like that. So one of the nines in Herman Cain's 999 plan was actually a value-added tax. Paul Ryan proposed a value-added tax. One of the deficit commissions, the Nunn-Domenici Deficit Commission, proposed a value-added tax. But nobody calls it that because, if you call it that, then people fear it's the instrument of European socialism.
Right,
call
right.
it a business transfer tax or a consumption tax, then all of a sudden it's a right-wing pro-investment, pro-saving tax. So it's got a problem with the name, but even people who don't want us to head the way Europe has headed in terms of spending admire the efficiency of the value-added tax.
You're never going to get Joe Kernan to sign on for it for that very reason. It's the equivalent of signing up for European low economic growth. I'm reminded of the comment that Lyndon Johnson, when he saw Walter Cronkite coming out against the Vietnam War, and he said he lost the battle when he lost Walter Cronkite. And, until someone publicly, and Herman Cain probably is not that person, but until, kind of popular conservatives would accept the idea of a VAT, I don't think it's going to go anywhere. And Joe Kernan's not there yet. So I unfortunately agree with you. You did point out, though, in the carbon tax, for which you have a separate particular specific chapter, in a way, kind of a carbon tax is almost an industrial VAT. Is that an unfair summary of it? Or is it, would you not want it viewed that way?
That's interesting. That's an interesting perspective. I've never thought of it that way. It is a tax on the consumption of carbon, the way that a value added tax is a tax on all consumption. So its effects in terms of being regressive would be similar to value added tax. But again, there are ways to offset that regressivity. I just feel like a carbon tax is such an important step that we need to take right now, not just for budgetary reasons, but especially for climate change reasons.
Yeah, and it is that the logic of that is beginning to, not the logic of the tax, but the logic that is carbon, not just climate change, but carbon consumption showing up in everyday life. On my travel vouchers for my firm, the itineraries, it shows the amount of carbon associated with my stay at a hotel when I travel on business. And I unfortunately travel by plane quite a bit, and it shows each flight the estimated carbon that flight will consume per passenger. And these are big numbers. They at least get you to think about your activities when it's presented to you in that way every single day.
Right. And I think that's important, just getting the issues in front of people and reminding them that these are issues, whether it's long-term debt or the need for more investment or the need to address climate change. We're all bombarded with information every day, trying to get these ideas in the front of people's minds, I think is part of the political challenge.
And you've outlined a huge problem, and then you've proposed a huge solution, silo by silo by silo. It almost seems enormous. And one is left asking the question, which you answer in your final chapters, what can practically be done? And to overcome the political challenge, which is the first step of overcoming the economic financial challenge. And you have an immodest proposal, and you want to, how do we get the ball rolling? Well, this is it. You want to outline that.
Sure. I think the important thing, the most important thing is that we don't have to do this all at once. In fact, it's almost be impossible to do all these things at once. The amount of decisions that would have to be made would just be overwhelming. But the basic idea behind fiscal therapy is it's kind of like physical therapy. You pick a problem spot, you work on it, you try to fix it. Then you fix another problem spot, you work on it, you try to fix it. And so I think this will happen. You know, the optimistic scenario is that it happens dribs and drabs over time. The pessimistic scenario is it doesn't happen at all. But I think ultimately, I think there are two things that you know, we talked about the political problems. I think there are two things that will help guide the process. One is that fiscal sustainability is ultimately consistent with both conservative and liberal goals. Conservatives want a financially sound government. Liberals want an active government that requires resources. And the other thing is, as I talk about in the book and as people have discussed elsewhere, there are enormous benefits to fiscal reform. I mentioned using the necessary changes as an opportunity to help grow the economy, help increase economic mobility and the plight of low-income children and families. And so there are you know, eventually the notion that we can make ourselves better off by dealing with this problem will come to the fore, or at least needs to come to the fore.
I noticed one way that you try to make it more palatable is, you know, through a commission that at least would, you know, a neutral commission in which the conservative members are chosen by the liberals and the liberal members are chosen by the conservatives.
Right. Yeah. You know, everyone rolls their eyes when you say we need another commission. And, you know, Washington is littered with the history of commissions that nobody in Congress ever paid attention to after they were done. So I thought that if we were going to do a new commission, I thought there would be two requirements to make it work. One is that Congress would either have to vote on the commission's proposals in an up or down manner, or the commission's proposals would actually take effect. And the other is that you see this in recent commissions, you get the most...
That means they can't ignore it. That
right.
is, if you don't vote it down, it's going to go into effect.
Exactly. So, yeah. Exactly. And then the other thing would be, on the commissions, you tend to get strident members on the committee, the most conservative and most liberal, and not surprisingly, they can't agree on much. And so I thought it might work better if each side picked the members of the other side that were on the commission, is saying, look, these are the people that we can work with best, or we feel most comfortable with, or we trust the most. And that might actually be a productive way to reach some sort of agreement at the commission level.
I thought that was rather clever. Well, I wish you well. The book just came out in early April, so I don't know whether the feedback from Washington, given there's a lot going on in Washington these days, it really is a challenge to our lawmakers, and hopefully it will be addressed. The book is Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future by William Gale, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Bill, I want to thank you for chatting with me today, and I hope this book contributes to some forward progress.
Well, let me thank you for being on the show. I've enjoyed talking.
Very good. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Take care.